Chapter 2. Sometimes on our long brooding watches when we skidded southward in a following sea, I remembered my last meal on the carrier. There was the usual chaff in the chief petty officer's mess, but I, Harold F. Dixon, aviation chief machinist's mate in the United States Navy, ate mostly in silence. Our 11 o'clock chow, that was, and in 3 hours I was taking up a small bomber in the routine scouting. I rose and turned to go to the ready room, where the pilots get their wind data and plot their navigation. Then I stopped at the door, turned, and looked back at the table. We'd had celery that day. Most men preferred the tender celery hearts, but I've always liked the hard outer stalks. Without thinking of anything in particular, I walked back to the table, took 2 more stalks of celery, and ate them slowly. As I reflected on this later, it seemed to me that I was under some compulsion to stoke my body for an ordeal to come. I have thought many times that this was a strange and fortunate thing I did, for that luncheon was to be my last meal for 34 days. I had occasion to wish that my premonition, if premonition it was, had gone a little further and made me take an extra swallow of water. Going past the sick bay, I was stopped by a first-class pharmacist's mate. "Want to see something?" he asked me. "Yes," I said. He said, "I have a friend of yours in here," and opened the door. I looked in, and there was this fellow lying flat on his back in bed. His arms and legs were waving back and forth in the air, and he was talking to himself. This man was a very good friend of mine. He had a very dangerous job on the ship, and he and I discussed several times his chances of getting hurt. In fact, we'd been talking about this a day or two previous. He told me what he was going to do in case a certain wire broke. And by golly, this particular morning something did happen. I don't know why. And he got his head cracked very hard on the landing. He was just standing at his place, and whether this wire broke or not I never found out, but anyway, his skull was crushed very badly. I had that funny lift in my stomach. I had a feeling that something was going to happen. The doctors were there trying to give him an examination. He was babbling. You couldn't make out his words. His voice just went on and on, rising sharply and then falling to a whisper. I said to the first-class pharmacist's mate, "Think he'll live?" The pharmacist's mate didn't say what he thought. He just shook his head. That funny feeling came again. I thought to myself, I'm going to be in exactly that same position. I could see myself lying flat on my back with my legs in the air. Then the thought came to me. This fellow is suffering by the way he is groaning. Mentally, there is something very badly wrong with him, and his subconscious mind knows that. I thought, I'm going to do all my suffering before my mind goes out, and that will be the climax. My wife and I believe in spiritualism. We're very ardent spiritualists. I've had these premonitions, and I had another right then and there. I used to go up and take my exercise walking the deck of the blacked-out carrier, and sometimes lately I'd look at the white foam thrown by our wake on a long black swell and feel somehow uneasy. I took these long walks every night and calisthenics every morning, deliberately keeping my body fit. I think Gene Aldrich and Tony Pastula did the same thing. We were in the best of health, all three of us, and I think that's why we came through our ordeal. January 16th was the day. January 16th, 1942. I walked up to the ready room and went about my business to stand by. The hop wasn't to take off for a couple of hours. I think I still had 2.5 hours to wait. I always spend my time in the ready room. It's a regular hangout for pilots because there is where we get all our military data. Everything from the bridge comes down there. All the wind dope, likely enemy positions, the last word on everything the bridge knows that might help a pilot. I can't tell much about the ship or what we were doing. We were on a war mission. There's a discretion to be observed. Anyway, I went to the ready room. I was not required to be there until an hour before takeoff, but I went up right after lunch. I don't remember talking to anyone. The wind data was starting to come in, and the pilots paid close attention. This day the winds were variable and didn't seem to hold in any one direction. First, the aerologist would send down the data on wind from one direction of a given course. In about 10 minutes, there would be another direction of wind. There were probably half a dozen changes of wind in that last hour I was there. That's quite variable. All the talk was on navigation. It is customary in the squadron that the pilots check each other's navigation problems. One of the officers wasn't going out, and he checked on mine. We get the wind and other data. I'd rather not go into detail about this, and much of it is mathematical, and work out a problem in navigation, and that's what we go by in the air. We each worked on my problem, this officer and I, but in the meantime, they stuck up about 3 changes of wind in the last half hour. We finally agreed on a likely direction of the wind, and I just finished my problem when word was passed to man the planes. There's no wasting time here. The pilots dash right up to the flight deck and prepare to take off. My bomber was standing ready. We were looking for Jap submarines. I guess it's all right to say that. Submarines are where you find them. The young sailor standing by my plane was to be the bomber with me. The gunner was in the plane. We had 3 cockpits. I was forward, Tony Pastula, the bomber, in the middle cockpit, and the gunner behind. That was Gene Aldrich, as it turned out. I didn't see Gene until the next morning, as a matter of fact. When we went in the water, I was busy, and then it was dark, but later on we introduced ourselves with more or less formality. I got a bomber and a gunner, and this time it happened to be Pastula and Aldrich. Later, Tony said he had made a couple of hops with me before, but I don't remember. Aldrich I had seen around. He knew me a little better than Tony did. Gene flew all the time. When I was not flying or in the ready room, my job on the ship was in the educational department. I'd been running this for many years, and it required most of my time. I instructed Aldrich along with other boys in radio and different subjects. I remembered instructing him, but always in a group with several others, so I had never paid much attention to him as an individual. The three of us just knew each other's last names and rates. There's always some excitement for me in taking off from a carrier. If you don't feel it, you can't be a born flyer, that's all. There are shouted orders, and the whole ship seems to come alive when all those motors begin to growl. All the things a pilot has to check, there's no sitting back to enjoy the show, and a show it is. But I feel a tug inside, and something swells like the roar of the crowd at a football game when they kick off. Maybe it's more like the start of an auto race, when the flag comes down and the noises rise, and then everything begins to move, and the broad, bright flight deck falls away. You're up. We took off at about 2:15 p.m. and proceeded on our mission. I could see a plane to the left and another to the right as I went out. As I said, we were on a scouting hop, looking for enemy submarines or surface vessels. The day was clear, with scattered clouds. Scattered clouds, that's technical language with us. It means that approximately 1/4 of the sky is obscured, with clouds here and there. These were bright white cumulus clouds against a sharp blue sky. The sunlight had that glassiness peculiar to the tropics and put a glare on the almost purple sea. Everything looked fine. This flight was to take us to the maximum range of our aircraft, not to be too definite about it. At the end of our outward leg, I looked off to the right and then checked the altitude. The sun was probably 45 minutes high yet. There were 2 very large rain squalls, one to the right and one to the left, and I passed right between. I could see the sun under the cloud formation. It made a very heavy golden glow on the water. I figured that the ship should be out in that direction, to the left, but the sunlight made the water like looking into a yellow flame. It was getting to be time to look. I called on the interphone. Pastula, can you take a drift sight? You do that with an instrument, which I needn't go into here, as it is military. Tony answered, yes, sir. Tony was a mechanic. He was supposed to take these things apart and put them together again. So when he answered, there was no question in my mind that he could take a drift sight. I called for a wind estimate, and then called again for a check. Wind estimates are tricky things. Even the best bombardier can go wrong on one, and conditions were none too good for such an estimate. But when the same answer came back the second time, I figured it was probably correct. If so, the ship should be to the right. If the estimate was wrong, the ship should be to the left. I decided I should take the wind estimate as being correct and turn to the right for a search. I wasn't particularly worried. I still had some safety factor. But I knew something had gone wrong and that I had missed the ship. The two boys also knew by this time, and from our maneuvers, that we had missed the ship. However, we hadn't started to worry. There'd been no conversation between us. Our only communication was by means of the interphone, and talking is strictly confined to the business of the flight. Until now, it had been a dull afternoon. We hadn't seen anything that looked like an enemy, so the boys had had a little workout with our practice ammunition and dummy bombs, which we carry for this purpose. Now I dropped real bombs to get rid of their weight, and then made for altitude. The next business was to get a bearing back to the ship by radio. I called the ship for a bearing. There was no answer. I called, and called again. Silence. By this time, I knew we were becoming hopelessly lost. The gas was just about running out. Grasping at a straw, I turned the plane and steamed on until the gas was down to 10 gallons. This would keep us in the air only a few minutes. I passed back word to stand by for a landing in the water. I had no recourse left. These carrier-based bombers are land planes, of course. They're not built to float, but one can at least expect the plane to stay on top of the water the time it takes to inflate the rubber life raft, stow the emergency gear in it, get aboard, and shove clear. The raft is folded and tucked into a small cover and is standard equipment for planes of this sort. It is inflated by opening a valve to a tiny flask of carbon dioxide. The thing works in very much the same way as a home-charging seltzer water outfit. When the valve is cracked, the imprisoned gas rushes into the inflation compartment of the raft and expands, blowing up the raft like an inner tube with a thin blanket of the same rubberized fabric covering the hole to make a floor. Pastula, I called back on the phone. Bring the rations, water, life raft, and anything useful you can get hold of. Here, take these. I passed him my chart board, automatic pistol, and shells that were in my pocket, and a pair of pliers. Bring the parachute, I added. Aldrich was to furnish the first aid kit, signaling devices, and any other loose gear that might be valuable to us. I'm going to make a landing in the water, I told him, and wait for them to come back and find us. Ready, Aldrich, Pastula? Ready, said Aldrich. All set, from Tony. Their voices were calm. I squared away then, into the wind, to make a power stall landing. The sea was calm and slaty. The sun had just set, and darkness was rising in the sky to the eastward.